Okay, good afternoon, everyone. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
Can you hear me there?
Yes, we can hear you.
Could someone just open the microphone and let me know if you can hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
Okay, thanks, Maria. So welcome to these lectures of the second week of this Applied Time Series Analysis course on financial economics. And this week we are actually moving towards actually the time series models. Last week we discussed more like about general linear regression models. And the problem in those kind of models is actually that you usually have to have some kind of economic or financial theory related background for finding out the regression model that you want to actually focus on using empirical methods. So basically, based on the theory, you should have some kind of idea about the left-hand side variable, which means the dependent variable or the regressant in your regression model. And then based on the theory, you should have an idea about the relevant set of information used on the right-hand side of that regression model. So what does the theory say about the probably exogenous or independent or the variables that should be treated as the regressors in your linear regression model? So in many cases, this is based on theoretical assumptions and theoretical derivations of the model, and you should be able to end up to a situation where you can estimate this model based on a linear regression approach. So you should be basically be quite sure about the essence of the role of the variables in the model. So which one is the actual left-hand side variable that you are interested to explain its behavior? It can be time series observations of that variable, and also the right-hand side variables are time series observations of the relevant information set that is conditioning. So we are talking now about these X variables on the right-hand side and Y variables on the left-hand side. But in time series analysis, it has actually been for ages already a case that it is actually quite hard to beat so-called univariate models in terms of, for example, out-of-sample forecasting performance based on these linear regression models with a conditioning set of variables on the right-hand side. And this is why these univariate models have gained such a huge interest among the statisticians and econometricians, because they can be used in many cases as a very good benchmark models for forecasting exercises. Why forecasting would be interesting, especially in financial time series. Case of financial time series, it's obviously interesting for you as a, let's say, stock market investor to be able to forecast the future return of the firm or the stocks of the firm that you are interested about to interest. So in that case, you should have some kind of information set that you would be able to use to forecast the future returns. Relevant information set might be, for example, the general index returns. They might be correlated with the individual stock firm returns or the stock returns of the firm. But in any case, it's more like an kind of an ad hoc choice that the economic and financial models can only give an idea. So for example, capital asset pricing model obviously gives you an idea about the relevant information on the right-hand side when you want to explain the excess returns for a for example, Stockholm Nokia. So basically, the excess return on the market portfolio should be the first factor that explains the excess returns on Nokia. But it can only explain a certain amount, a certain fraction of the variation in the returns of Nokia. So, for example, if you extend this capital asset pricing model towards consumption-based capital asset pricing model, for example, then you have aggregate level consumption as one of the factors that might be explaining the excess returns, or you might have other macro-related variables. But nevertheless, it is obvious that probably the Nokia return as itself is some kind of a dynamic process. So the past values of the returns are able to explain the current observations of the returns. So you do not basically perhaps need any kind of exogenous information for this. It's just enough for you to try to extract exactly as the best possible way the dynamics or the role of the historical observations for the current observations of the return. And this is what the univariate models are about. And the main assumption behind all these analysis in this week is that we are now discussing about so-called stationary time series, which means that all the inference that we discussed last week about the OLS parameter estimates, their reliability or their unbiasedness, can be basically used as a background or the starting point for the discussion of the relevance of the parameter estimates also estimated from the univariate time series representation of the data. Here I have a set of books that are probably relevant to you. And for example, this Brooks book is the one that we are using in this course, but there are also other books, like for example, this book by James Hamilton. I will show it to you here. It's called Time Series Analysis. It's a thick book. It's like a Bible. For those of you that get to be as much in love to these models that I am, this is a very good reference also. And then originally I actually got to be in love with these models when I used this book, the Time Series Analysis, Forecasting and Control, originally written by Box, Jenkins and Reinsel. And then this fourth writer, Greta Ljung, who is actually a Finnish origin. She's a statistician from University of Turku. Actually, she wrote this fifth edition of the book. So if you start to be as much in love with these models that I am, then perhaps you should also take a look at these books, because they give a very nice theoretical background for all the models that we are discussing this week, basically. And actually for most of the models that we are covering in the whole course this time. So in addition to these books that have been listed here, you can also have a look at those two very, let's say, almost like a Bibles in time series analysis. So the main thing here that we are now discussing is the univariate time series models today. Put it simply, for funds and market applications, they are to be used in trying to predict the returns using only information contained in their past values. So the information in monthly frequency, for example, when you're considering allocations at the monthly frequency, the information from the last month or 2 months before that, or even 3 months before this point of time might be relevant. So the main idea in all these analyses is try to reveal the role of the past history of returns, for example. You can apply, obviously, these models to any kind of time series models when you assume that the data generating process of that time series is stationary. We will be discussing about non-stationarity next week, and that is actually one of the key assumptions in doing univariate and also multivariate time series analysis. So first, some notations and concepts. When we are talking about a strictly stationary process, it means that the probability distribution of the observations at any point of time is exactly the same in any of the subsamples. So the probability of getting this observation that is of size B1 and the later observations that are of size Bn in the later observations of that time series, they are exactly the same at each point of time. When you go in subsamples, so let's consider, for example, that you are considering now as a first subsample, you are considering the weekly observations from 2018, and then compare those to the weekly observations of returns in 2019. If the process for those observations is stationary, then you should have an equal probability of getting certain values, for example, for the returns at certain points of time in those subsamples. So the probability measure for the sequence of observations of the time series YT, it's the same as that for any set of observations, some periods in the future, for all the relevant periods in the future. So this A letter, upside down A letter, refers to the all observations in any distant futures. But this is actually quite a strict assumption. This is something that usually never holds in the actual time series processes, because it would basically indicate that all the observations are the same at each and every time point, or they are increasing with the same magnitude from each and every time point. So you are able to sort of extract a constant trend from this time series. And this is usually not the case in most of the time series. The trend might be varying over time. So usually, as a background for these, for example, these box Jenkins type models, it's enough to say that we assume that the data generating process of that time series is weakly stationary. Weak stationarity means that in this sample, we have a constant expected value or the constant sample mean. And then also the second moment, the variance is constant. So it's not indefinite, it's a definite, it's a constant thing measured in subsamples. And then one of the very relevant assumptions regarding weakly stationary processes is that the consecutive observations are not, their autocovariance is not dependent on anything else than the distance between the observations. Not the size of the observations, but the distance of the observations. So this is the last assumption. So when you consider or calculate the autocovariances between the observations from some point of time compared to the other point of time observations, then the size of this autocovariance is only dependent on the distance between the observations. So the longer the distance, usually the lower is the autocovariance or the autocorrelation. You can calculate the autocorrelation from the autocovariances, obviously. But the main idea here is that the closer to each other the observations are, the higher is probably also the covariance. So the main idea for you to understand here is obviously that when you consider these kind of things, you have to always form the lagged values of that series that you are interested about. And then that is a separate sort of a time series. So you originally, for example, have a time series of S&P and 500 returns, where you have 120 observations. When you construct a one period lagged series of observations, time series of observations, you will be missing one observation. So you will have only 119 observations for the lagged values. But after you have constructed those observations, so you formulate those as a new variable, then you can obviously start to go to calculate the covariances and also the correlations between the observations for certain time period. Let's say from the second observation onwards, you are able to calculate the correlation between the t time t observations and time t minus one observations, obviously. So basically, in these univariate time series analysis, you are always talking about lagged variables and lagged observations and their correlation with the contemporaneous at the moment observed observations of the same variable. So I think that this is one of the key things for you to understand. So basically, these are sort of a constructed new variables, but they are still based on these data generating processes for the same time series that you are considering. And then it is obviously very much important to assume something about the means. So if you are calculating the mean value for the 120 observations, it should not be statistically different in the set of 119 observations for the lagged values, if you are desiring to meet the requirements for the weekly stationary process. And the same applies for the variances or the covariances. And so basically what we are trying to do here, so if the process is a covariance stationary, all the variances are the same and all the covariances depend only on the difference between the T1 and T2. So from how far back in the history are you measuring the observations? That is the key thing. And usually the further back is the history of the observations that you are considering, the lower is the covariance or the correlation between the current observations and the observations from the very long past history. So the moments of this thing here are known as the covariance function. So it starts from the contemporaneous observation. So obviously this lambda, it's not lambda, it's actually gamma s. For the contemporaneous observations, it gets the value of one. So always without any lags, or the covariance is obviously one. But it starts to diminish immediately after the first lagged observations, when we start to consider the autocovariances between the first lagged observations and the contemporaneous observations, it's not one anymore. It's something below one. So these covariances between the current observations and some set of past observations. So for example, if you set up a series of two periods lagged for observations, then you are calculating the difference of this series, two periods lagged observations of this original series, minus the expected value of two periods lagged observations. So you are losing two observations from the beginning of the time series, yt. So basically, you have two variables here, and you can calculate the covariance function between these variables. But they are generated, they are from the original time series YT. Both of these guys are from the original time series. So you have to just understand this lag function, the role of lag function here. So the values of autocovariances depend on the units of measurement of YT, obviously. So if you are calculating autocovariances for different variables, then it is obviously a bit difficult to do comparison of those in terms of the autocovariances because, for example, you might have a percentage values for another variable and then just simple log values, for example, log of GDP for one variable. So they are measured in different units. So this autocovariance function is actually dependent on the measurement of the unit of the variables. So it's much more convenient to always use the autocorrelations because they are unit free. So they are just autocovariances divided by the variance. So you calculate this autocovariance at zero lags, which equals the variance, and then multiply the calculated autocovariance, let's say, for example, for lags two. So then you calculate this as the ratio of the two periods lagged autocovariances to the variance of the series. So you are able to calculate the autocorrelation coefficient at lag two. Then if we plot these against the lag structure or what are the lags that we are considering, then we obtain the autocorrelation function. And this is called, in many cases, it is just called the correlogram, autocorrelogram to be exact. Then some special cases. The first important one is the so-called white noise process. Basically, the white noise process is something that we always aim to achieve in a good regression model for the residual series, because it's meeting these nice requirements. So it doesn't have a discernible structure. So by definition, its expected value is actually a constant. Its variance is constant, and its autocovariances or covariances look like this. So they are also constant. So they equal the variance if the measurement point equals the analysis of the lag length or the lag length that you're focusing on, and then it's zero otherwise. So it's a behaving like a series that just varies very randomly. So it's actually virtually impossible to forecast a white noise process. It can go equally, probably it can go upwards for a one percentage point, then it can go downwards for a one percentage point. So it doesn't have a discernible structure at all. So the autocorrelation function will be zero in every point except for the single peak of one at the variance when the autocorrelation is zero or the correlation structure, the lag length is zero. So it's approximately normally distributed with expected value or the mean zero and the variance depending on the sample size. So obviously, the higher is the sample size, the lower is always the variance. And we can use this as to do, this is useful for us to do the significance tests for the autocorrelation coefficients by constructing a confidence interval for those. So as an example, when we assume that this is a normally distributed variable, a 95% confidence interval can be given based on this usual or this standard equation for the confidence interval. And obviously here you see that the higher is the number of observations, the lower or the tighter is the confidence interval. So these values get to be estimated more precisely. The more you have information, the more you have observations. So obviously this gives you good reasons to always try to get the biggest possible sample size in all your empirical analysis, because basically everything starts to be getting estimated more precisely. The standard errors, for example, for the parameter estimates for individual regression coefficients are getting smaller and smaller when you have more information. So if this sample autocorrelation, in this case, when we are considering the sample autocorrelation coefficient, so we are plotting it or we are analyzing it, and so we mark this hat over the correlation notation tau. If it falls outside this region for any value of this lax, then we reject the null hypothesis that the true value of the coefficient at lax is zero. So we are now, in this case, we are looking for the significant coefficients. We are looking for, we are trying to reveal the relevant past information that is affecting the current observation. So we are looking for significant autocorrelation coefficients, because this refers to the null hypothesis that it is not significant. Okay, so we have these hypothesis tests for these significance of these correlation coefficients, autocorrelation coefficients. So we can test the joint hypothesis that all M autocorrelation coefficients are simultaneously equal to zero. And this is something that you just have to rely that or believe that this is true, and you can do this like using this, because this is one of the test statistics that the George Fox and Pierce actually derived already in 1960s. And it's based simply on the observation of the number of observations. So T is here referring to the sample size, and M is referring to the maximum number of lacs that we are interested in analyzing. So what is the maximum number of lacs that you would be interested in? Basically, it is more or less, it's not dictated, but you can have an idea about that based on your sample frequency. So if the frequency of your observations is monthly, so obviously it might be the case that the observations from 12 months ago, like last January, when you're considering the current observations, January observations, they might be relevant, because you might have this kind of seasonal variation. In economic and financial time series, you often have some kind of seasonal variation. So when you have monthly data, an obvious choice for the maximum lac length to be considered would be perhaps something like 12. If you have quarterly data, then obviously for the same reasons, a relevant maximum number of lacs might be 4, because observations 1 year from the history might have a role to do in determining the current values. If you have weekly observations of returns, for example, once again, the observations from the first week of January 1 year ago might be relevant for the observations for the current first week of January. Then obviously in that case, the maximum lac length would be 52. So it is always, it's more or less based on your frequency of your data. But it has been proven by these guys, and they are actually discussing about the theoretical foundations, how to derive these test equation actually in that Box Jenkins and others book very thoroughly, much more thoroughly in that case than, for example, in the Hamilton book. let alone these applied books that we are using here, don't pay too much attention to the calculation or statistical theory for this test procedure, because you are an applied econometrician. You want to just know what is the relevance of this test. It gives you an idea about the probable meaning of the historical observations. What are the relevant lat lengths to be used in your model when you try to forecast the future values, for example, of Nokia returns? It has been proven that this guy is asymptotically distributed as chi-squared distribution, where the degrees of freedom m is referring to the maximum lat length. So if you are testing for maximum of 4 lacs, then degrees of freedom is obviously 4. You don't have to go to the statistical books anymore and take a look at the chi-squared distribution there. The programs report the probability values for these chi-squared test statistics for you ready. Well, these Boxpeer statistics has quite poor small sample properties, especially when you have observations that are the number of observations that is below the so-called Brownian motion marginal value, that is 400 observations. So this is the part where this Greta Ljung actually stepped into the picture with George Box, and she developed a new statistics with her PhD supervisor George Box in 1978 to calculate a more valid test statistics to test for the significance of these autocorrelation values, autocorrelation coefficients. And it's just an adaptation of this same original Box and Pierce statistics that takes into account that it has these small sample bias. So it first of all takes into account, obviously, once again, the number of observations, and then M here once again refers to the maximum lat length, but K here now refers to the number of estimated parameter estimates in the ARMA model. So it adapts also now the model towards more efficient parameter estimates or estimates for the autocorrelation coefficients. And these statistics is actually nowadays, it's Greta Ljung is actually one of the statisticians that she's now living in America, in the US, and she has not published very much, but this PhD thesis chapter has received almost 4,000 quotations already. And it is her major achievement actually in time series analysis. And it is something that is a very standard procedure nowadays in all the econometric programs. When you are focusing on the possibility of autocorrelation in, for example, residuals of certain linear regression models, Ljung-Box statistics gets to be reported more or less as a standard, one of the standard statistics in almost every kind of econometric programs. For example, in R and WinRATS, you get it. And in STADA also, you get it as a very much a standard reporting of the results. So it's very useful for a test of linear dependency in time series. So this is the one that you should actually be using when you have normal amounts of observations, around hundreds or something like that. So you are able to get rid of the small sample bias there. So as a practical example here, suppose that you have estimated for, let's say, a data series or time series on the Nokia returns, for example. You have estimated the first 5 autocorrelation coefficients using a series of 100 observations and found them to be like this. So the first autocorrelation, so we are now skipping the autocorrelation at 0 lacs. So we are not interested about the variance here. We are just interested about the order covariances, and the thing that it has been reported here is the orderable relations. So you can obviously calculate these by using the variance series and then the estimated order covariances on the series. First one is positive, second one is negative, third one is positive, and fourth one is wildly positive, and the last one is negative. Test now each of the individual coefficients for significance and use both the Box-Pearce and Leung-Box tests to establish whether they are jointly significant. So you are able to do either of these tests. Everything has been reported. Number of observations has been reported, maximum of lags has been reported, and all the individual autocorrelation coefficients have been reported. So just do the summing over the 5 observations for the autocorrelations and then multiply by the number of observations, that is 100, you can get the values. And equally well, you can get the Leung-Box statistics because the same information has been given. So in this case, you just have to sum over first t minus k, but the first kk is 1 first, and then it goes up to 5. So take this small sample correction into account when you calculate this Leung-Box statistics. And you get statistics values that for the Box-Pearce are 5.09, and for the Leung-Box statistics, very close to that one, but it is now taking into account the small sample bias. And because we have only 100 observations here. And you can compare this with the tables that are reported in most of the statistical and econometric books, but you can get obviously a p-values nowadays for this reporting, but in terms of the intuition about the results. So basically, coefficient would be significant if it lies around outside the confidence interval of minus 0.196 and plus 0.196 at the 5% level. So it would seem to be based on these values, actually, you can already detect that only the first one is outside this. All the other ones are inside this. So basically, just by eyeballing these reported correlation coefficients, you can actually also detect the result that the first one would be seem to be the relevant one. But when you are testing this, or you are using this Leung-Box or Box-Pearce statistic, you have to remember that you are testing for the joint significance of the chosen first 5 autocorrelations. So you're not just focusing on the first one or on the fifth one, but you are testing like an F-test in a linear regression model. You are testing for the significance of all these. So they actually, the four of these are basically dominating in these results because 4 out of 5 are not significant. So when you are doing this kind of joint test, you actually get the result that the 5 coefficients are not jointly significant. 4 out of 5 are not significant. But would this kind of reporting help you in any way to get an idea that what could be the data generating process for this time series? The answer is that yes, these reported parameter estimates, because the first one actually seems to be statistically significant, or not parameter estimate, but autocorrelation coefficients, it actually might be the case that some kind of process that is capturing the effect of first lagged observations could be valid to give a representation for this data series that you are considering now. But before going into these actual presentations of the data series, actually, I would like to show you this site that is often used as a background to give an idea about what are we actually discussing in terms of using these autoregressive and moving average models. When I open this from this slide, are you able to see it now?
No.
Are you able to see an example of moving averages, simple and exponential?
No, we're still on the moving average processes slide.
No, so I must stop sharing. And then I will start a new share. So I will go here and then share this one. Are you now able to see it? Yes. So this is something that people sometimes get confused about when we discuss about using time series models or univariate time series models to model the behavior of the considered variables. So it's a bit different when we are using ARMA models compared to using simple moving averages. Most of you are probably already aware of these kind of procedures on how to calculate the moving averages. So I want to give you this site as one of the possible sites to be used to get a clear understanding about the what is the calculation procedure when we are calculating simple moving averages. But as a sophisticated financial econometrician and a professional, a future professional in financial markets, you have to always be clear on how have you calculated the moving average representation of your data. Is it just simply based on the actual observations? So obviously, here are some examples on how to calculate, for example, a 5-day simple moving average for a series of observations. So basically, you are just first using the first 5 observations and then roll over to use, drop the first one and then use the next 5 observations. And then you get this value as the second day, a 5-day simple moving average. And then at the final stage, you drop the first 2 observations and then calculate these as the 5-day simple moving average of the observations. So here all the calculation is based on the actual series. And that is a bit different thing compared to these ARMA models that we are using actually. So obviously when you start to use these kind of calculations for a series that changes for some reason or other, more or less abruptly in certain time points, they usually are not very much able to capture, depending on the lag structure, how many lagged observations are, or what is the set of moving average window? How big is your moving average window? The longer is the window, the wider is the window, the more get the historical observations to have an effect on the next value, the moving average. So if something happens here abruptly, so it's probably not able to capture those kind of changes very smoothly or very quickly. So here are very simple examples of how to use. You can use obviously exponential moving average calculation also. So here are quite nice examples about how to calculate these kind of things. So take a look at this, that, and there's actually a spreadsheet, Excel spreadsheet that you can download also from here. And you can actually, if you have time, you can go and have a look at this so that you can get an idea about how to calculate. So here you see that the abrupt changes actually affect quite a long, but depending on the number of observations or the window for the calculation of the moving average, it starts to take into account also changes in the time trend. But this is something that actually gives you an idea that what are we actually doing when we are using ARMA models. And in terms of practical performance or practical doing in the markets, many financial analysts actually use some kind of moving average representations when they try to forecast the near term, very near term behavior of returns or prices of financial assets, for example. So what they are trying to do, they are trying to identify the trend and changes in the trend based on the averages. So when here the trend starts to change, you see that the moving average representation is only able to capture that with a certain lag. Not immediately when the trend starts to change here, but here the moving average trend actually starts to change. So basically that is just giving you an idea that how to use these. So take a look at these sites. This is actually something that many practical or many market participants actually are using. Take a look at this. This is actually very useful for you because you will run up with these kind of things when you go to the markets. Most of the guys are using, and there's actually quite nice a book by John Murphy there about this so-called technical analysis at the financial markets. This is technical analysis, and you are doing everything based on the past behavior of the time series of the returns that you're considering. And the simplest possible way to capture these structures of this time series, which means that we are discussing about this technical analysis, is to use a moving average representation. But in this course, we want to emphasize, or I want to emphasize to you, that this is perhaps not the most efficient way to make use of all the data that you have available in your time series. So I would very much encourage you, when you go to the markets and start working with this time series, don't be satisfied for these simple moving averages when you try to forecast some. Take at least into account the possibility that it actually might be more useful to use some kind of autoregressive moving average process. So it is very easy to do. You can do this in Excel also, and you have plenty of possibilities. For example, R, you can download that to your computer when you go to work in the marketplaces and try to fit an ARMA model. Don't be satisfied for a moving average model only. And the main idea in the ARMA model is actually that the moving average representation of the data is, it's very easy to calculate, but if you are just satisfied for calculating the moving averages, basically it might be the case that you are not able to capture these sudden changes in the time series so well. So let's start the discussion still of how to formulate an autoregressive model based on this moving average representation of the data. So what we are doing here is actually that we are now, once again, we are considering a linear regression model. We are starting from a scratch, basically. So we are starting from a model for the Nokia returns, for example, in this case. So we have, let's say we have 100 of observations regarding Nokia returns. It's a sequence of independently identically distributed random variables with expected value for, so we are not focusing here, UT doesn't refer to the actual returns, but YT refers to the returns. But we are assuming that we are able to somehow say or model that those observations of Nokia returns based on a constant term. So there's some kind of mean that is probably not zero. It can be zero, but it also can be something that is statistically significantly different from zero sample mean. Usually in stock market returns, it is the case that at least in monthly frequency, for example, they are something that is different from zero. But when we want to use this moving average modeling or autoregressive moving average models, we always have to use some kind of regressor or something here on the right-hand side to explain the behavior of the actual returns, for example. So basically, we are now saying that when you deduct each and every observation from the sample or mean, it is being well captured by some kind of moving average representation from a linear regression model where the only regressant is actually, a regressor is actually the constant term. So you start from a linear regression for the Nokia returns and use only the constant term as the explanatory variable. It's a model that you can estimate using linear regression model parameter or the estimators approaches, and you get the residual series from that. So if there is a dependency between the historical observations of the residual term, then there might be some kind of lag structure that is relevant in the error terms from that regression model that has a role to do in determining the current observations. So this is basically a bit different thing compared to just calculating simple moving averages. Basically, you start from a regression model here. You have something that is being used as information that is relevant, that is the constant or the sample mean, basically. And you are explaining the current or all the observations with the sample mean, and you get the residual series. You can print the residual series, and you are able to see that there seems to be some kind of dynamic dependence between the residuals. So the current observations do have a role, obviously, to the current observations of Nokia return, but lagged observations of the residuals might also have a role, and the two periods lagged observations might have a role up to the lag structure of Q periods lagged observations. So in this case, we are now talking about the moving average model, not just the moving average values, but we are talking about the moving average model because we are modeling the behavior of the residuals actually here. How are the residuals here? How are they correlated in terms of the past observations amongst others? So obviously we have a case here where now we can assume that the expected value for the Nokia returns is a constant thing. Yes, because we have, it may be zero, but nevertheless, it's zero in all points of time, expected value in all subsamples for also the lagged values of returns. It's still expected value of those lagged values is zero, or it is mu. It can be something that is different from zero. But the variances can be calculated based on the estimated parameter estimates for the effects of the lagged residual series here. So covariances can be calculated also based on these effects from the past history of the constant variance of the observed series. So now, as an example, you will be doing these things in the demonstrations. You will get a more clear idea about what are we actually doing when we are doing these ARMA model regressions. If we can assume that a relevant data generating process for the Nokia returns or any other time series that we are interested about is captured, it's being described by a constant term plus current period observations for the errors and one period lagged observations for the errors and two periods lagged observations for the errors. So this is an MA2 process because only up to two lags we are now allowing that the past history has an effect on the current observations. So we are considering here the actual time series, but it is a series that can be described by the past history of the residuals from a model. So UT is a zero mean white noise process with a constant variance, and you should calculate the mean and the variance of X based on this parameterization of the X series. And you should derive the autocorrelation function for this process, express the autocorrelations at first and second and other longer lags as functions of the parameters of theta 1 and theta 2. Assume that you are estimating this model and you get the parameter estimates. You will be doing plenty of these things in the demonstrations also, and I will show you also examples. You have estimated, and the first parameter estimate is minus 0.5, and the second lag effect comes through the estimated 0.25. Based on this, how would you calculate or how would you characterize the autocorrelation function of the actual X observations? Are you able to do that? Yes, you are able to do that. I will show you next. So, if the expected value of the error terms contemporaneous observations for UT is zero, then obviously for a stationary time series, it should be the case that also from any period, lagged period, the expected value for the lagged observations should be also zero for each and every lag. This was one of the starting assumptions for a stationary data generating process or stationary time series process. So when you impose these assumptions, these relevant assumptions for the stationarity of the considered time series X, so you should be able to calculate the expected values for the actual observations of X just based on this UT series. So just plug in this representation of the actual observations. This is a function for the actual observations of Nokia returns. It's a function of these guys. And we have now imposed some assumptions regarding the expected value for these, actually. So plug in just that xt equals ut plus theta 1 times ut t minus 1 plus theta 2 times ut minus 1. So because this is a linear representation of the X, then you can calculate all these separately. So this is an expectations of the UT plus theta 1 times expectations of UT minus 1 and theta 2 times expectations UT minus 2. So because we are assuming that it's a stationary process, so the assumption of the expected values is applying in each and every point of time of all the observations, then this is a sum of null values. So the sum of nulls is obviously null, it's a zero. Then just plug in to the representation of the equation for the variance, how to calculate the variance for a stochastic process. It's an expectation of the actual observations minus the expected value for those observations times this second time. So xt minus ext. Once again, based on our assumptions, it should be actually because the expected value of xt is zero. So variance goes like this. So plug in now the representation of XT once again. So XT is an MA2 process. So just plug in into this theoretical variance calculation the representation for XT. So it's UT plus theta 1, UT minus 1 plus theta 2, UT minus 2, multiplied by the same guy once again. And you get this kind of representation. Multiply these open these multiplications, and you get these so kind of cross products here also. So in this case, for example, you get to be multiplying theta 1 times ut times 2 ut minus 1 with ut in this case. But since we had an observation or assumption that the cross products are not correlated, or the cross observations are not correlated, because covariance between the observation of u from current period is not is zero against the observation from some lag period, any lags or any lags. So this applies to all the lagged observations. So these cross products here, for example, this theta 1 times u times t minus 1 times ut, and also theta 1 ut minus 1 times theta 2 ut minus 2, it's also zero because of these characteristics of the cross products. Then basically the only thing that is affecting here are these squared values, ut to the power of 2 and theta 1 squared times ut minus 1 squared plus theta 2 squared times ut minus 2 squared. So basically, we can calculate the variance like that. So it looks like that. It doesn't look very nice, but it's a clear parameter. It's a clear parameterization of the variance using the representation of the XT series as an MA2 process. So variance that can be denoted to be this gamma zero. So at lag zeros, we are considering the covariance at lag zero, it's equal to variance, can be given by this equation. So it's based on our assumption that this should be actually expectation of ut to the power of 2, it should be constant. So that plus theta 1 to the power of 2 multiplied by expected of value of ut minus 1 to the 2, it's once again the same constant variance of the error term, and plus theta 2 to the power of 2 times once again this sigma squared. So we can combine all the things that have an effect here on the sigma squared, 1 plus theta to the 1, theta to the power of 2 plus theta 2 to the power of 2 times the variance of the error term, the ut term here. Okay. The main thing here is just to understand that if you have estimated an MA process, MA2 process, so here is one of the things that we are using here. So if you have estimated, then you should be able to calculate the theoretical variance for that. Theoretical variance is based on the MA1 parameter and the MA2 parameter and the estimated variance for the error term, the ut. Then, what does the autocorrelation function look like? The second or the first after the variance, the first thing that we are interested about is the first lag effects, the effects of the first lag. So the autocovariance at the first lag is the next thing that we are interested in. By definition, we are using the same idea here as we did for the variance, the same principle. So we are now considering the contemporaneous, this period observations, their deviation from the expected value of those guys, times the same thing from the previous period. So we are now considering expected values for the one period lagged observations of X. So we can calculate the expected value for that too after we have set up a series of one period lagged observations. So obviously for that series, we can calculate the expected values. So it's an expectations of multiplying xt with xt minus one. Once again, if we are assuming that a relevant representation for the xt is an MA2 process, then we can impose or block in that representation. So here's once again that MA2 process for the XT. And if it is a stationary process, then it should be the case that obviously the same representation applies also for the one period lagged values of XT. So this is the reason why we write here the same data generating process, the MA2 process, should apply also for these lagged values of XT. So multiply these guys with these guys. And once again, you get to be analyzing also cross products, but based on the similar ideas that we used, or assumptions here, is that the covariances between the cross products are zero. So basically, this goes actually to a representation where we are calculating the expected value for theta 1 times u t minus 1 to the power 2 plus theta 1 times theta 2 times u t minus 2 to the power 2. So this is basically getting towards a bit more, perhaps a bit more simple representation once again. But the relevant thing here is that once again, we can also express this autocorrelation function at the first lag in terms of autocovariance, calculated autocovariance, by using these parameter estimates. MA1 parameter estimate plus MA2 times MA, MA1 times MA2 parameter estimates, and those, the sum of those two multiplied by the residual variance or the UT variance, gives us the autocorrelation or the covariance value at the first lag. So we are calculating here the autocovariance. What about autocovariance at the second lag? The same thing goes through here. So basically, just plug in the same guys. Now we are considering the autocovariance between current observations and two periods lagged observations. So when we set up this time series, we are losing actually two observations from the beginning of XT, because the first observation is possible to be recorded only from the third observation. First observation for two periods lagged series is possible to be considered only from the third observation of the original series XT. So plug in the representation for XT once again, and consider the same representation for XT at point T minus 2. So it is obviously UT minus 2 plus the effect from the period before that, theta 1 times UT minus 3 plus theta 2 times UT minus 4. So once again, we have these cross products that, based on the assumption of the stationary of the time series, go to zero. So we can skip those ones. If you open up this multiplication, you get to this kind of situation where expected value is based on the expected value for the theta 2 times ut minus 2 to the power of 2 can be given based on this. So it is going towards more simple representations regarding the autocovariances. And actually, you end up into a situation, assuming that an MA2 representation still is the varied, is the valid representation for the actual observations of X, you are now ending up into a situation that actually, based on this, it is actually the case that the third order covariance is now already zero. So if a good representation, time series representation of the data generating process for XT is a MA2 process, then the autocovariance theoretically should go to zero from the third lag onwards. So it should not be statistically significant from the third lag onwards. And this is a statistical or the theoretical representation that has been very, very thoroughly and nicely expressed also in that Box Jenkins book, and also in actually the Brooks book. But this is something that from a practical applicant's point of view is relevant to remember, just to remember that if a MAQ representation, so MA representation with Q lags, is relevant for the time series, then after that Q lag, let's say for example fifth lag, it should be the case that autocovariance is zero. So taking a look at the calculated autocovariance is based on the actual data, you can have some indication about the relevant moving average representation of the data generating process. So now that we have autocovariances, we can calculate the autocorrelations. Just remembering that for each and every lag, so without any lags, we are considering now basically the variance. So autocorrelation with zero lags is always, theoretically, you can say that it is always one. For the first lag, it is the representation of the autocovariance at the first lag that we derived in the previous slides, divided by the representation for the variance. So it's something like this. So it's a mixture of the effects of the MA1 term and MA2 term. For the second lag, once again, we can calculate the autocorrelation. So this is useful for you to do because this is unit-free measurement of the dynamic dependency between the observations. So basically, at the second lag, you can use the representation for the autocovariance at the second lag divided by the variance once again. So it's getting simpler and simpler. And right from the third lag onwards, if the MA2 representation is the one that is the relevant, it should be the case that the autocorrelation is actually zero after the third lag. So all the autocorrelations after the third lag should be zero. So when we plug in these theta values, so this is the theta value, the parameter estimate on the first moving average lag, and this is the for the second MA2 component. Then if we substitute this into the formulas that are given here, we can actually calculate the sample autocorrelations for the first lag and also for the second lag. And the first would be fairly big, negative, minus 0.476, and the second one is already much closer to 0.19. So this is based on the assumption that MA2 is a relevant process. So after that, we can calculate the theoretical values for first the autocovariances and then for the autocorrelations. So the autocorrelation function plot would look like this. At the zero lags, we had this one, and at the first lag, minus close to minus 0.5, and at the second lag, something close to 0.2, and right from the third lag onwards, it's something that is actually zero. So basically, when you start from a scratch, you don't have an idea about the relevant data generating process. You don't know that it's a MA2. What would you do? You have the sample. You can do basically the calculation of the autocorrelation function or the autocorrelation values at various lag based on your actual observations. So you can calculate the autocorrelation values because you know the variance of the series, and you are able to do the lags of the series, first lag and second lag and so on. So you can calculate the autocorrelation fractions. So based on your sample, if you get something like this, it might give you an idea that perhaps a relevant data generating process could be an MA2. MA1 might be actually enough to capture this actual data generating process of this X variable. But MA2, depending on the number of observations completely, it might be the case that still also the MA2 part is relevant. Then, so this is actually something, this MA analysis is something that we basically start all kind of ARMA or autoregressive modeling from these kind of representations, because intuitively it's very easy to understand this through this moving average calculations. But this is not exactly the same thing that is just the plain moving average for the actual observations, because we are now fitting a best possible model to the data based on the simple representation that you can perhaps capture the actual observations, behavior of the data series just by explaining those with the constant term. And then we are focusing on the residual behavior, dynamic behavior of the residuals from that model. How are they related? Is there something that is being left unexplained from that model? So is it possible to capture the left or the dynamics of the series that you are analyzing based on the dynamics between the past observations of the UT? But obviously, to me, even more intuitively relevant representation of, for example, stock market returns is this autoregressive process. So I would like to suggest that we now have a, let's say, 10 minutes break. So my computer time is 15:30. So let's have a 10 minutes break for to take a cup of coffee, and then let's continue from this discussion about autoregressive process. So be back here 20 to 4. Okay, I suppose everyone is back from the coffee break, so we can continue now. So let's move on to the second possibility of the simplest possible univariate times representations of the stationary data, and that is the autoregressive model. And to me, actually, this is even more intuitively understandable to do a regression where I have actually the explanatory variables are the lagged values of the variable that I am interested. So I have formulated a data set where I have these, let's say, stock returns for the Nokia company, for example, on the left-hand side. So I'm explaining those with the constant term and one period lagged values for that same return series. So I have constructed a separate data series where I am losing now one observation from the beginning of the data set. And then I have constructed another variable that is two periods lags of the Nokia returns. So I'm losing, in that case, I'm losing two observations from the beginning of the data set up to the lag number of P. And the problem here is that what is the relevant number of lagged terms here? What is the relevant order P? How many lags should I include to this model? Is it relevant to include only 2 lags? Is it relevant to include actually 12 lags? So in that case, in addition to the constant term, I would be estimating 12 different parameter estimates in the linear regressive model. Once again, the key thing to understand here that we are aiming towards a white noise process for this UT always. So we are trying to get the best possible representation of the actual observations of Nokia returns based on its historical data. And we are trying to get a best possible regression model in terms of the residual behavior. So this guy, UT, in the best possible model, should have a constant expected value, preferably 0. It should be normally distributed, and its variance should be constant, and especially the autocovariances between these guys, you know, the lagged observations, the current contemporary observations of UT, they should be 0. So there are lots of things that actually this guy here, lots of requirements that this guy here has to meet in order for us to give a good representation of action for the actual series of data series, time series of the Nokia returns. In most of the statistical or econometric books and articles, instead of writing out this model in this linear form, in many cases, the authors use this kind of lag operation notation, but this is just for the purpose of using shorter expressions for these models. So L times Y T means that we are lacking one period, the actual observations Y. L to the power of I times UT, YT means that we are lacking I periods. So for example, L to the power of 12 times YT means that we are considering 12 periods lacked values for YT. YT minus 12. So basically the same equation here can be given in a shorter expression using this kind of expression, or the same thing can be given by using this kind of representation, that actually we are now imposing that there's a function also for this parameter, the lagged effects parameter values that can be given like this. So basically, these are just different representations of the same equation for the actual observations. Use the one that you are able to understand the best. It's exactly the same thing. For me, because I'm quite a simple guy from the countryside, so actually I want to write out everything, because it can be actually the case that some of these guys might not be here relevant, but these guys, for example, here might be relevant. So there's absolutely no need to have a representation that we have consecutive observations in terms of the lags that are all relevant. We can have a non-consecutive AR model. So for example, first period lag values can be relevant. And for example, the fifth period lag values can be relevant. So P here is 5, and everything in between those is not relevant. 2, 3, and 4 periods lag values are not relevant. Basically in that case, it is actually something that this function representation doesn't actually hold for all these guys here. So there are 0 observations for some of these. Also, so basically you can choose which one you prefer for the representation. But the main thing here is that we should always aim towards stationary representations of the data. And what are the stationarity conditions? Condition for stationary divergent or ARP model is that the roots of the so-called difference equation, or this characteristic equation, all lie outside the unit circle. Don't pay too much attention into this mathematical representation. If you are a very big fan of mathematics or statistical mathematics, take a look at this Box-Jenkins book, or for example, the James Hamilton book that I showed you. They derive there all the theoretical statistics that is required to consider this condition. But I will give you the main ideas in terms of the applied econometrician's needs. A stationary ARP model is required for it to have a moving average representation as an indefinite moving average representation, because we want to get to this kind of representation. This is the so-called Wald decomposition idea that is also being discussed also in the Box-Jenkins book, for example. Don't pay too much attention to this one either, because this is just for the purposes for easing the calculation of the theoretical autocovariances and theoretical autocorrelations for an ARP model. We need this one because it's easier to calculate based on that moving average representation that we considered in the previous slides. Just pay attention to these parameter estimates. This is the main thing for you as an applied econometrician. So if you are using an AR1 model, this is an AR1 model because the AR parameter estimate here is 1. The question is this representation stationary? Testing for stationarity actually is focusing on testing the statistical properties of this residual series here. Characteristic root, it can be proved that the characteristic root of this equation is actually 1, so it is a unitude process. And the main idea here in terms of the relevant AR models is always to take a look at the coefficients on the lagged effects. And if you are considering an AR1 model, is the coefficient on this AR1 term, the one period lags, is it statistically different from one? If it is different from one, it can be, usually it should be below one to have a stationary series, because if it's over one, then you have an exploding series. Each and every time point when there comes a shock to the observed observations, it has a more than one effect on the next period observation. So it's an exploding series. You can have these kind of situations, and we will be discussing about these also next week when we do the tests for the stationarity. Example two is here also relevant. So can anyone tell me, open a microphone, and can you tell me what kind of AR model are we considering here? What kind of AR model? Is this an AR1 model? Just open the microphone, because I'm not able to follow you in the chat very smoothly. So just open the microphone. Is this an AR1 model? No, it's not an AR1 model, because we have also the lags, two periods from history and three periods lagged values here as explanatory variables for the current observations. So we have formed separate series when we are doing this regression. For example, we are explaining the contemporaneous observations. So we have originally this time series for stock returns for Nokia, for example. Then we have set up a series of lagged observations. So we are losing the first return, just lagging the actual observations for Nokia for one period. And in this case, we have two period lagged values from the same series of YT. And in this case, three period lagged values. So we have a data generating process assumed to be an AR3 process. So we are assuming here that it's relevant to model the behavior of Nokia returns based on an AR3 model. It might actually be the case that it is the best possible representation, even though you would be regressing a model where you have the, let's say, the Nasdaq returns as an explanatory variable. You are not able to get a better forecasting model in terms of auto-sample forecast compared to this AR3 model. The main thing here to take a look at is that you can calculate theoretically, actually, these characteristic roots of this difference equation. So this is involving the third differences, actually, of these YT series. But from a practical point of view, just pay attention to the sum of these lagged effects parameter estimates. So 3 plus 0.75 is 3.75 minus 2.75. You get to the sum of 1. So basically, you get to the same situation here, that you might actually have a non-stationary representation of the YT series. Theoretically, we can calculate the characteristic roots. Basically, this could be done by error and trial first. Try the first possible that you have in mind, that would be for the value of z to be 1. And you actually are able to show that it actually solves this characteristic equation based on these parameter estimates. And then after that, it's obvious that yt minus 1 times something that is of a quadratic form is also a solution to this quadratic equation, or this characteristic equation. So you can actually solve this and get the roots of 1, 2 over 3, or 2, 3 parts, and then 2. So basically, only one of these lies outside the unit circle, so the process is non-stationary. This is something that is theoretically proven, for example, in that Hamilton's book and other things. But from the practical point of view, don't pay too much attention to these theoretical derivations. You just have to have an idea about the relevance of the model that you are trying to estimate. Is it really appropriate? And in applications or empirical applications for an applied econometrician, you have these unit truth tests that we will be discussing next week that are of help to you. So, but the main thing here is that if you are now estimating an AR model, take a look at these parameter estimates. What is the sum of those? If you sum up something close to 1, then you might be having a trouble in terms of the stationarity of that time series that you are considering. And here is that wall decomposition theorem that I already mentioned. It states that any stationary series can be decomposed into the sum of 2 unrelated processes, a purely deterministic part and a purely stochastic part, which will be an MA, indefinite MA process. And this is of help to us in theoretical terms to calculate the autocovariances and autocorrelations for an ARP model. So obviously we can give the ARP model in that form here when we are using this LAC function. And we are now ignoring the intercept in this presentation. Obviously, it's possible to do because we have a regression model where we have the lagged observations of the actual series now. So we can do that. But the Wald decomposition just postulates that you can give this representation of the Y series as an indefinite representation of the moving average components that being captured by a moving average model for the residuals, the UT terms. So basically, based on the similar ideas that we already discussed regarding the theoretical autocovariances and autocorrelations for a moving average representation, you can apply when you are acknowledging that a stationary time series, a valid ARP model, should be able to be presented as an indefinite moving average representation of the error term. There's something going on with my VPN connection, so I have to do this. Hopefully I didn't lose my connection. Are you there still?
Yes, we can hear you.
Are you still there?
Yes, we can hear you.
Yes, good, Nico. Thanks. So the main thing here is that we have to sort of understand this thing that we are able to calculate also the autocovariances from a relevant representation of the data based on an AR model. But we are using this Wald decomposition theorem for that purpose. So the moments of an autoregressive process based on this Wald decomposition idea can be also calculated based on these parameter estimates So there is something wrong. I cannot hear any one of you. I have to correct this for next time. You have been commenting me all the time, but I don't hear any one of you. Sorry about that. Good that you can hear me. So
could you now open up a microphone and say something? Hello. Yes.
Hi, guys. Nice to hear you. You have been discussing all the time and I haven't been hearing anything from you. I had two sets here in connection, so good to hear you. This has been a bit boring just to talk by myself. Okay, so just open the microphone if you have any questions. So we are discussing now about this calculation of these means and so on for a autoregressive process. So obviously you can calculate the mean by dividing the sample mean, expected value for the process by dividing the sample mean with one minus the parameter estimates that you have been estimating to the AR process. So you can calculate also the autocovariances and autocorrelation functions that they can be obtained based on solving what are the so-called Ewald-Walker equations. Once again, I encourage you to take a look at this Box Jenkins book and also the Hamilton book where they discuss about these things. But as an applied econometrician, you don't have to understand this. Just understand the sort of a final outcome from this. What is, in terms of applied econometrician, what is relevant in this? Autocorrelation function, one of the relevant things here to remember is that if the AR model is stationary, the autocorrelation function will decay exponentially to zero. Remember that. Autocorrelation function will decay exponentially to zero. In case when we derive the theoretical autocovariances and autocorrelations for an MA process, we found out actually that if for a stationary MA representation of the data, let's say, for example, MA2 process is valid, then after the second lag, all the autocovariances and autocorrelations go zero from the third one onwards. But this is different in case of the autocorrelation function for an AR model. It doesn't go immediately to zero. It starts to decay from the last relevant lag. So the simplest possible representation for the data is obviously an AR1 model. So you are just using one period lagged values for example, Nokia returns as the main explanatory variable in this representation. So you can calculate the unconditional mean, you can calculate the unconditional variance, and for the remainder of this exercise, let's assume that the constant term here is zero. And you can derive actually the autocorrelation function also. So the solution looks like this. Unconditional mean is obviously mu plus theta 1, actually phi 1, this is phi. Have to remember these Greek letters always. It's phi times e expected value of the one period lagged series, time series. But also you have this representation that it should be holding also the same AR representation for the contemporaneous observations should also be applying to the one period lagged observations. So obviously if you are using this in the calculation of the expected value for the whole series, then obviously just plug in for the one period observations the same kind of AR1 representation. So the two period lagged observations are relevant to explain the one period lagged observations. Just remember that. And then obviously you are able to calculate for each and every, because this same AR1 process should also hold for the two period lagged observations. So obviously for these guys, it should be holding that yt minus 2 is equal to constant term plus phi 1 times expected value of the three period lagged time series. So basically you can calculate that. And infinite number of these substitutions would give you this kind of representation for the expected value of the contemporaneous observations of Nokia stock returns. So the main thing here is now that we are assuming that this parameter estimate here, this phi 1, it is statistically significantly different from 1. So this is a stationary time series process. So if it is so, then we can basically use the idea of geometrically decaying time series or series of observations, because this is will be a geometrically decaying series. For some of those, we have this equation that it should be mu divided by 1 minus phi. So assuming that this is the absolute value of that is statistically different from 1, so it is below 1, then we have this situation that we can calculate. So we have a finite expected value also for the YT. Same idea goes here for the calculation of the variance. Remember, just the representation of the data is AR1 always. And based on the Wald decomposition theorem, we can give this AR1 process as an indefinite process of the error term. Take a look at the theoretical books of statistics to deepen your understanding about the Wald decomposition theorem, but let's take that as a given thing now. So long as we are still assuming that we have a stationary process, this will converge to this kind of representation once again, because the five things here, they are the lag on the first, the value on the first lag, parameter estimate on the first lag is absolute value of that is below 1. So basically we can calculate again the variance, but because now we are assuming that the constant term is 0 for simplicity, the expected value is 0, and we can calculate the variance now. Once again, we are now, this is for the purposes, this is giving us the reason why we want to use the Wald decomposition idea, because we want to get rid of the cross products, and we have an assumption that the covariances of the error terms, they are 0. We want to utilize that thing here. This is the main reason for why we want to give this definite AR1 process as an indefinite process of the error terms. This is the only reason. We want to get rid of these cross products in this case. So we are able to calculate the variance. And turning now to calculating the autocorrelation function, first calculate once again the autocovariances. So this is for the first lags. Once again, set the constant term to be 0 and use this assumption that the expected value of yt is 0. And also that applies to this series, that the expected value of one period lagged observations is also 0. So by definition, we are now calculating the autocovariance for the first lag, then multiply current observations with the one period lagged observations, take the expectation of that, just plug in the representations using the Wald decomposition now, because we want to be using these assumptions regarding the cross products once again. We want to use the zero assumptions for the cross products once again to be able to give the representation for the autocovariance for an AR1 process. I know that there are a lot of things that are not, for the first time, they are really confusing. They are really disturbing, but I will try to lead you towards the practically important things in terms of trying to somehow be able to identify the optimal ARMA models. For the second autocovariance, we once again are using the AR1 representation here. So once again, the same thing applies as previously. We are trying to make use of this assumption regarding the error term, their autocovariances. So we are once again using the assumption that they are 0, so we can get rid of these cross products once again. So for the second autocovariance, so this is autocovariance between the contemporaneous observations of YT and two periods lagged observations. So it looks like this. Looks like this. The main thing for this guy here is also that, as was the first autocovariance, you can give that in terms of the model parameters. So you can give that in terms of the AR1 parameter. It's AR1 parameter times the variance of the error term that is assumed to be constant in a stationary series divided by 1 minus the AR1 parameter to the power of 2. The same thing here. For the second lac, you can also express this autocovariance using the AR1 parameter estimate and the constant variance under residuals, or the UT, and divided by 1 minus the AR1 parameter to the power of 2 once again. If these steps are repeated for the third autocovariance, then we have this representation for that, and for any lac, the autocovariance would be given like this. So it stays the same. So basically, it doesn't stay the same because it goes lower and lower. So this gives the decaying idea in the autocovariance and autocorrelation function, because the more you have, the higher is the S term here, the power or the power of this phi term, obviously the lower is the effect of the UT variance. We are dividing always by 1 minus phi 1 to the power of 2, but this guy here is always getting lower and lower and lower when we raise that to the power of higher powers all the time. So we can derive now equally well the autocorrelation function using these same ideas as we did for an MA representation. Now that we have calculated the variance and we have calculated the autocovariances at different lacs, and they look like this. So basically, the only relevant information in the case of AR representation to calculate the autocovariances is actually the AR parameter. So basically, after the second observation, it is already something that is starting to diminish. It's because we have this power of 2 here, and here we have the power of 3, and it goes lower and lower and lower. So for an MA process, it seems to be the case that autocovariance function goes directly to the zero after the last relevant lac, but not for an AR process. For an AR process, it decays, and the relevant information is the value of the AR parameter estimate. That is the relevant value, or the relevant thing. Then, when we are using this Box-Jenkins approach, this is named as a Box-Jenkins approach. This is a fairly old approach, actually. This is a more like a graphical approach that focuses on the role of autocorrelation and partial autocorrelation function. In the usage of autocorrelation function, we assume that the cross products are not actually relevant. But when we want to sort of relax that assumption, we actually assume that there might be some kind of role to do also in the lacs that are between, let's say, if we are considering the autocovariances or autocorrelations between the contemporaneous observations and four period lacs observations, then if we assume that the cross products are, they have a role to do, we should also take into account the role of these second and third lacs, that they might be correlated with the contemporaneous observations somehow, second lacs and also the third lacs, but they come from these cross product effects. So partial autocorrelation function takes care of that. And I won't go through these. If you are very interested about the statistical theory behind R1 models, take a look at the Box-Jenkins book. I familiarized myself with these things when I did my PhD thesis over 20 years ago, but from a practical point of view for an econometrician, you just have to understand that in terms of the partial autocorrelation function, when we had the case for the autocorrelation function that the for a relevant MA process, autocorrelation go to zero after the last relevant lac. For partial autocorrelation, this actually applies to revealing the relevant AR process. So for partial autocorrelations, they go to zero after the relevant lag in case of an AR process. So it's just the other side of the same coin now that we are discussing. So it measures the correlation between YT and YT minus K after removing the effects of the observation correlations of the observations in between these two K lags and the current observations. And at lag one, autocorrelation is always the same as the partial autocorrelation. At lag two, it is equal to something that is a combination of the second lag autocorrelation and one first lag autocorrelation. So it's a non-linear representation of these actually. And already from this, you can say that when we start to consider that the first and second lag might be differently correlated than are the first and third lag and the second and third lag. So this obviously gets to very nasty representations, but that's not the relevant. That's not the relevant thing for you to understand these formulas for calculating of this, just to take the interpretations from these. Partial autocorrelation is useful for telling the difference between an AR process and an ARMA process. We always try to go towards the most parsimonious representation of the data. So that means that we prefer using an AR1 instead of ARMA11, where we would have an first lag of AR and first lag of MA process, because it has two parameter estimates to be estimated. So take a look at the partial autocorrelation function in that case when you are deciding about the relevance of the AR process or ARMA process. In the case of an ARP, there's a direct connection between YT and YT minus one only for the relevant lags that are below the maximum lag of P. So for an ARP, for example, if a AR4 model is the relevant model, the theoretical partial autocorrelation function will be zero after the fourth lag. So from five onwards, the partial autocorrelation will be zero. We had the same thing in the case of an MAQ model for the autocorrelation function. So this is now the other side of the coin. Use the partial autocorrelation function to do this inference now. In the case of an MAQ, this can be rewritten as an AR, indefinite AR process, so there are direct connections between YT and all its previous values. And this is the MAQ interpretation. If an MAQ process, let's say an MA4 process, is relevant, the theoretical partial autocorrelation will be geometrically declining. So we have the same coin from the other side now once again. We will be going these through quite soon, so we have some practical examples of these. By combining these ARP and MAQ models, we can obtain this ARMA PQ model. And in some cases, it can be actually that for forecasting purposes, an ARMA model can actually bring out more efficient out-of-sample forecast compared to a AR model. Let's say an ARMA11 can be more efficient in producing out-of-sample forecasts compared to an AR2 or MA2. But remember that in both these cases, you have exactly the same amount of parameter estimates to be estimated. In AR2 model, you have two lags, first and second lag. In MA2 model, you also have first and second lag, but that is for the error term. And in ARMA11, you have only one lag for the actual observations and only one lag for the residuals of that series, basically. So basically, in many cases, this representation actually results into out-of-sample forecasting exercises, into better forecasts than these ARP or MAQ, AR2 or MA2 process. But nevertheless, still So this is a general representation for an ARPQ model. So you have PLAX of the actual observed variable and QLAX of the error term, actually. So based on this, actually, you probably have an idea that it's actually, in terms of forecast performance, for example, it is actually useful to try to get to a most parsimonious representation, because you might have situations that actually it's not necessary to capture anything here in between when you are capturing that the first lag is really important in terms of actual observations, and for example, monthly observations, the 12th lag that is capturing the seasonal component in monthly observations might also be relevant, but nothing in between. For the MA representation, it might be the case also that it might be useful to fit this kind of representation, that the first lag of the MA term is also relevant, but only the 12th lag. So you can estimate these non-consecutive models, actually. And they are kind of a non-linear representations of the data. But they can lead into a more parsimonious models. So degrees of freedom stays at an adequate level when you don't have to calculate too many parameter estimates in the estimation procedures. Try to get to the most parsimonious representations, the least possible number of parameter estimates to be used. Here's the invertibility condition that is also relevant. Similar to the stationarity condition, we typically require that the MAQ part of the model to have roots greater than one in absolute value. The mean of the ARMA representation is given here, and the autocorrelation function for an ARMA process will display combinations of behavior derived from AR and MA parts. So it's actually, to summarize this, this is the original Box-Jenkins idea of how to try to identify the best possible representation of the time series when you don't want to use anything else than the history of that actual series. But you try to capture the historical effects the best possible way. Make use of everything that you have available. You want to utilize the actual past values of the series, but also basically their moving average, role of their moving average observations also. So you are capturing, so basically that actual observation part could take care if there comes a sudden change in the actual time series, like a structural change, like at the start of the corona crisis, we observed this very, very sudden change in the stock prices that is actually can be characterized to be a structural change if you are trying to model this using an ARMA process. These are the things that you just have to remember. So basically this slide from this almost 2 hours discussion already, these are the things that you have to remember. Autoregressive, an AR process has a geometrically decaying autocorrelation function. Number of spikes in the partial autocorrelation function give you an idea about the relevant AR order. So how many lags in the AR part you should include to the model. Moving average process has a number of spikes of autocorrelation function giving you the idea of the relevant moving average order, and it has a geometrically decaying partial autocorrelation. So when you want to find a relevant representation for the data using just an AR model, then take a look at the partial autocorrelation. Which one is the last one that seems to be statistically significant? And are the rest of the partial autocorrelation values, are they zero? For an MA process, take the same look at the autocorrelation. What is the last statistically significant autocorrelation value in terms of the lags? And do the rest of the autocorrelations, do they go to zero? Then it can be a combination of these. And this is actually one of the reasons why this original Box Jenkins approach has actually received quite a lot of criticism. It's almost impossible to try to detect a relevant ARMA process for a time series just using these ideas. As an example of about the difficulties when trying to extract the best possible ARMA model, I have downloaded to the Moodle webpage one article that I wrote when I did my PhD thesis. It's the first article in the thesis. It has been published in the International Journal of Forecasting. That gives you an idea about the difficulties in trying to reveal the best possible ARMA representation in a time series. I did that for the inflation rate, Finnish inflation rate, for the period of from 1970s until the liberalization of Finnish funds markets, because I wanted to generate the best possible inflation expectation series based on these ARMA models that I utilized in my other articles in the PhD dissertation. The work amount that I sacrificed to get this inflation expectation series was that I did various trials of the ARMA models, and it took me something like 6 months to try to get to the best possible ARMA representation. But I was able to extract all the relevant structural changes, so I ended up to using a very much non-linear representation of the Finnish inflation series. But I was able to produce a model that actually performed in out-of-sample forecasting exercises better than the models that, for example, Finnish Research Institute of Economy, Economic Institute, ETLA, and also, for example, Bank of Finland were using at that time. And they already used, at that time, they used a heavy-duty structural dynamic stochastic models to produce also the inflation forecast for the Finnish economy. So if you are prepared to do lots of work in trying to reveal the best possible data generating process using ARMA models, you are able to do that. It requires just a lot of work. Here are some examples. How do the autocorrelation and partial autocorrelation functions actually work? Or this is based on a 100,000 observation simulation with disturbances drawn from a normal distribution. So basically, this is not from an actual data, this is from the simulated data. And theoretically, it should be the case that when the relevant model is an MA1, so in this case, this is an MA1 process. We don't have even the constant term here at all. So basically, it should be the case that the partial autocorrelation function should be a decaying guy here. And it seems to be, it's getting slower and slower. And the autocorrelation function should go to zero immediately after the first lag. So it is the case here, actually. The red bars here go to zero, actually. So autocorrelation function goes to zero. For an MA2 process, we should have the case that after the second lag, autocorrelation function should go to zero, and it seems to be the case here. We have here ORLC 95% or the 5% risk level error bands here. So basically, this is not statistically significant anymore after the second lag. So from the third lag onwards, like it is the case theoretically, that the autocorrelation function should go to zero, it goes to zero. For the partial autocorrelation function, it's an oscillating series. What is the reason for this? It comes from the science of these parameter estimates. When we have pluses and we have minuses, we may end up into, or we should end up into a situation that is in an oscillating series when we draw the partial autocorrelations. Next one is for a AR1 process, but that is still a stationary process. So this is not exactly one. theoretically, it should be the case once again that partial autocorrelation goes to zero, statistically not significantly different from zero. It is the case after the one first lag, so from second lag onwards, and the autocorrelation function should start decaying. So it is the case. So already at the second lag, we have now here the case that 0.9 to the power of 2 is actually 0.81. So this is actually theoretically valid, also exactly the thing that we calculated in the theoretical calculations for the autocorrelation. So this is behaving exactly like it should be in theoretical terms. For a more rapidly decaying AR1 term, we actually have here the case that the partial autocorrelation once again goes to zero after the first lag, but autocorrelation starts to decay more rapidly. So we get to the value of zero, close to zero, actually already after the fifth lag for the autocorrelation function also. Autocorrelation and partial autocorrelation for a more rapidly decaying AR1 model with a negative coefficient. So once again, the negative coefficient causes this situation that we have an oscillating value for the autocorrelation function and also for the partial autocorrelation function actually in this case. So it's correct that the first is minus 0.5, second one is minus 0.5 to the power of 2, so it's 0.25 and so on. So it goes exactly like the theory says. Then this is kind of giving you an idea about how would the autocorrelation, a partial autocorrelation functions look like for a problematic time series that we will be focusing next week. This is something that you should not end up in having in your ARMA models. Or actually, this is something that requires something additional to be done for the original time series. So if you observe, you start from this box Jenkins modeling for a, let's say, Nokia returns, for example, and you draw these autocorrelation and partial autocorrelation functions. You can do this very easily. We will be showing that to you in using R and also Stata. And it's ridiculously easy to use, to be done in WinRATS, actually. And you end up into this kind of situation where actually the partial autocorrelation is exactly one at the first lag, but nothing after that. Autocorrelation function doesn't start to decay. So this is a problematic situation. This is actually something that sort of takes away from you the possibility to use the standard linear regression assumptions in any kind of inference regarding this model. So basically this should give you the first intuitive idea that perhaps you should do something for this series. You are not able to actually relevantly capture the past effects because all the shocks that come to this time series now, they always have a permanent effect on the next period observations. And that is actually quite problematic. It sort of wipes out the possibilities, the asymptotic properties of your parameter estimates, because the standard errors get to be estimated way too correctly. It doesn't actually capture the actual variation in the parameter estimates in the right way, in the relevant way. So this gives you an idea about the problems regarding that thing that you might end up so to this kind of situation. The simple answer what to do in this case is take a difference and then start to apply the ARMA models to the difference values of these. They should be behaving, you should be able to estimate perhaps, for example, this kind of data generating process for the difference values of the YT, or you should be able to estimate something like this. But nevertheless, you should not end up to reporting these kind of autocorrelation, a partial autocorrelation functions for the differenced values. So this is just to give you an idea about that. Then an ARMA 1-1 model here is an example of that. So you see here that actually now that you are using your graphical inference or your identification ideas based on partial autocorrelation and autocorrelation functions, it's not so clear anymore if the relevant data generating process is actually an ARMA 1-1. Because basically it should be the case that because the AR part is relevant here, the partial autocorrelation should go to zero after the first lock, but it doesn't do that in this case. Because AR1 is simply not enough. You need this MA1 process. So basically, when you estimate this actual model, you always have to take a look at the statistical significance of these parameter estimates. Always. Are they relevant or not? You get to be reported this from the at least the standard errors for these parameter estimates, and then you can calculate the p-values or the t-statistics for these parameter estimates when you have the standard errors for these parameter estimates. So when you end up, you might end up using actually a based on the behavior of the partial autocorrelation function, it might actually be the case that you end up using an AR5 model. So you would be using a model which have five parameter estimates to be estimated, because partial autocorrelation goes to zero only after the fifth lock. But it's much more effective actually to estimate an ARMA 1-1, because you might end up into a situation if you use an AR5 model that, for example, the third and fifth lacks might still not be statistically significant. So an ARMA 1-1 is actually easier. It's a nicer way of representing this data generating process for this YT variable. Now that I can hear you, I'm happy about that. I will not divide you to the to these rooms anymore. Just let's take a look at these reported autocorrelation or partial autocorrelation values and figures in the Vindrats example. So I will show you these. So let's just make a discussion now about the relevance of the models that perhaps should be used. So what are the ground rules for identification in terms of the behavior of the autocorrelation function and partial autocorrelation function? So basically, remind yourselves from this slide, actually. So if you have opened up this set of slides, then have this open, and I will now start sharing the actual report or the there. So I suppose you can see now this word. Can you?
Yes, we can.
Okay, so here's the reporting of the, once again, we are using the same data set. So we are doing the analysis for the 12-month changes in the log of industrial production index from the euro area. And tomorrow we will be actually doing the forecasting exercise regarding this. And I will download also the codes if someone of you wants to use RATS for estimations, but it's equally easy to use also R and Stata for this. But the thing that we are interested about is the forecasting ability of the term spread and the excess returns. And last time we were able to find out that actually this short-term interest rate, it is not relevant at all. Actually, we are able to get to a model where actually the term spread and the excess return from the stock markets are the relevant information that is useful for forecasting the and for the analysis of the future real economic activity. So I always start from this. I draw the figures And in this case, we draw now the actual lead values for the real activity changes that is measured by using the log of industrial production index from the Euro and UK. And this is for the Euro area. So we are interested about this black line here. Are we able to forecast that using the term spread? Well, the term spread would seem to have, just based on eyeballing these, it can be the case that it has something to do. Remember that now we are measuring various kinds of time series. So the scale of the series so is here for the excess returns from stock markets. It's different completely compared to the actually the real activity measures and also to the term spread measures. But nevertheless, the interesting thing here is that actually just based on these simple ideas that the term spread and excess returns should have a forecasting power, it might be the case because you see these changes in the time trends are actually in some points they are actually connected to each other to a degree. There are some periods of time when they are actually more like random. The connections are more like random, but there is something. And this is actually the reason why my interest actually awoke on these things, that it actually might be the case that we are able to use this. And this is based on the so-called stock watcher approach, that there is some kind of set of financial market information that is able to forecast the real activity. But obviously, if we want to compare the performance of this kind of model, I actually started the lecture from this. If we want to compare that model's performance in out-of-sample forecasting, the natural benchmark for that is always a comparison against an AR model. The best possible approximation of the data generating process for the real economic activity based on an ARMA model. Because it's a series that has a memory, the past values of that real economic activity changes, they do have an effect on the current observations. It might be the case that actually the moving average part also might have a role to do. So it is always a case that you have to consider, especially when you want to do forecasting exercises using some kind of regression model. These ARMA models from the ARMA family are very relevant benchmark models. So we start to analyze it from taking a look at the autocorrelation function. So what kind of behavior you see here in the autocorrelation function for this 12-month changes in the real economic activity from the Euro area. What does this look like? Do you see a jump-wise development of these autocorrelations, or do you see a decaying development of these autocorrelations? Have I lost you once again? Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you. And I can see that the autocorrelation is getting smaller.
Yeah. And do you see any kind of a jump-like behavior that it goes to zero after some lag or close to zero?
Yes, between the 10 and 11.
Yeah, there is a change there. It goes to zero, actually, but perhaps it's more like, would you characterize this as a decaying series?
Yes.
Yeah, okay, that's the right inference. What are the partial autocorrelations? So now you are focusing on two things. If you would have observed this thing that this goes suddenly, the autocorrelations go suddenly to zero, then that would have given you an inference about the possibility that an MA process might be relevant. But if you take a look at the partial autocorrelations, what does that indicate regarding the relevant data generating process? Is it an AR process, or with what lags it might be an AR process? is the first lag, is it big enough to indicate to you that an AR1 would be something? So it's this 0.95. It's definitely big. So it's actually giving you an idea that an AR1 might be a relevant, but here's a good example of this non-consecutive possibility of non-consecutive ARMA model or AR model, because the second lag is not, it's very close to zero. We have not drawn or given here the standard errors or significance of these, but this is just because I'm leading you towards a more relevant way of doing this identification process towards using the information criteria. We were discussing about those, but this gives you actually very nicely an idea that if you end up using an AR1 model, it might be actually that you get to be missing something, because the third and fourth lags, for those, the partial autocorrelation function is actually giving you coefficients for the particle correlations that might be actually statistically significant. And these actually, I have calculated the standard errors for these partial autocorrelations, and these are actually statistically significant. So basically, an AR4 model, partial autocorrelation goes very close to zero after the fourth lag. AR4 model with first and third and fourth lags included, but skipping the second lags, might be a relevant representation for the data. This gives you
How about the ninth lag?
Ninth lag is something that is on the border of significance, actually. But once again, I remind you about trying to get to the most parsimonious representation of the data. So final decision would have to be made based on after estimating this non-consecutive model using first, third, fourth, and perhaps the ninth. Ninth is going to be a bit questionable. So the final decision would have to be made based on after doing the regressions. We will be practicing this tomorrow. Whether this is statistically significant, this ninth lag, is it statistically significant or not? If it's not, then skip that one. You can get to a more parsimonious representation by using the first, third, and fourth lags. And this automatically actually also reports this Jungbox statistics for 12 lags. Automatically, you can choose actually the number of lags, but it automatically reports this for 12 lags when you are using monthly data in rats. But in R, for example, you have to choose this. And it now reports the Q statistics with decrease of freedom 12, because it's testing the maximum of 12 lags. And the statistics is quite high. Significance level is pretty much zero. So what is the inference regarding the significance of all the first 12 lags? Null hypothesis is that all the 12 lags are statistically not significant. So when you have a very low significance level, very high statistics value, test statistics value with the very low significance level, very low p value, it implies rejection of the null hypothesis. So altogether, the information in the 12 first lags, it is relevant. But the problem is that some parts of this lag structure might not be relevant. There are parts that are relevant, but some of those might not be. But this is the problem in these joint tests that you might end up. So basically, if you want to do this procedure and use this procedure, identification procedure based on the graphical analysis and autocorrelations and partial autocorrelations, you should actually do this for various lags. Try from various lag structures and try to do these I mean this test statistic, Ljungbock's test statistics. Then we have for these other guys, what is the message from the term spread? First of all, it seems to be the case that all the lags are significant, all the correlations are significant. So this is for the significance of all the correlations. But what can we say actually regarding the prominent models? Is an AR model or is an MA model? This is actually giving you a bit more clear message about the relevance of the models that we are considering. So take a look at this guy here. After the second lag, this goes very close to zero. It doesn't start rising there very significantly. This is still not statistically significant, but after the second lag, actually, it goes. So what does this indicate? Is an AR model or is an MA model the more relevant one? Probably an AR2 might be relevant because partial correlation, autocorrelation goes to close to zero after the second lag. It's still minus 0.34 in the second lag, but it goes to the close to zero from the third lag onwards. And the autocorrelation function is clearly now, even more clearly now, decaying. So this is actually something that might be characterized as an AR2 process. But nevertheless, I would encourage you to start also an ARMA11. ARMA11 in many cases is actually performing very well. So in both cases, you would have only two parameter estimates to estimate and compare the models, whether the parameter estimate on the MA1 part is statistically significant or not. We will be practicing these tomorrow. I will show you some. Then about the excess return from the stock markets. What kind of inference do you get there? Autocorrelations are once again decaying, not so smoothly as for the term spread data, but once again we have a case here that after the second lag, the partial autocorrelations go close to zero. They come up or they go more negative in the fourth lag and actually in the sixth lag. So obviously I would also try an AR6 model by leaving the third and fifth lags away. But nevertheless, the final decision should be made based on the statistical significance of all the parameter estimates. Ljungbock statistics in this case also, and it was the same here in the previous case, is implying to you that the all the autocorrelations up to the lag 12, they are statistically significant together. So the joint test for the significance of all those gets to be significant. So the null hypothesis that they are not significant gets to be rejected clearly. And here are actually the autocorrelation, partial autocorrelation figures. So you can draw these. I prefer actually using these figures in many cases to give some kind of indication where we do have these spikes. So we do have these spikes in some cases, for example, the real activity. And also for the term spread, we have these spikes in the partial autocorrelation and also for the excess return. For the term spread and excess return, we actually seem to have the spikes here at the same lag. Okay, so let's continue from this tomorrow. I will download after the tomorrow's lecture also the codes for this, and the data is already there available, so you can have a try and go also to do these things. So let's continue tomorrow at 9:15. Okay, have a nice evening.
Thank you.